be the mess my life has become. And when I'm done, I blow my nose, wipe my eyes, turn the key in the ignition, and find my way home. Chapter 29. As soon as I get to my room, I want to email A to take it back. But I have to be stronger than that, because I know that would be a lie, and I need to live with the truth. I have no intention of going to the homecoming game, and Rebecca and Preston have no intention of letting me get out of it. I might be able to resist one of them, but their combined force is too much for me. They call me on speakerphone from Rebecca's house. "You have to come," Preston insists. "I don't care if Mystery Man is planning on taking you on a tour of Europe this weekend," Rebecca says. "This comes first. Because we want you there. We need you there." "But Justin will be there," I point out. "So what?" Preston says. "We can take down that skinny-ass whiner if we have to." Rebecca sighs. "What Preston means is you can't avoid Justin forever. Our school just isn't that big, so the sooner you get the first time over with, the better, and we'll be with you the whole time." "Plus," Preston adds, "you'll go crazy if you stay home all weekend." True. All of this is true. Also, I miss them. "Fine," I say, "but you're talking to me the whole time. You are not going to expect me to watch high school football for 2 hours. "You've got yourself a deal," Rebecca says, and Preston cheers. I become hyper-preoccupied with what to wear, which was never an issue when I was going to see A. I guess I figured if he was going to show up in whatever body, I could show up wearing whatever. Or maybe I didn't feel like I was auditioning for him all the time, like I did with Justin. Rebecca, Preston, and Ben pick me up, and we head to the high school. It feels like the whole town is here. Even though our football team sucks, homecoming is a sort of big deal. Stephanie and Steve are with Justin and a few more friends, and Stephanie has promised to text updates about their location. I tell Rebecca that's not necessary. I don't need to be treated like there are restraining orders involved. I'm not worried Justin will attack me. I'm just worried about how sad it will feel to see him. Luckily, the stands are packed, and Justin's group is nowhere near us. As promised, we talk through the game, mostly Preston giving running commentary on the fashion choices of various people in the bleachers, with even Ben throwing in a remark every now and then. At one point, Preston says he's going on a pretzel run, and Rebecca volunteers to join him, leaving me and Ben alone together for the first time in a while. At first, I think we're just going to watch the game until Preston and Rebecca get back. But then Ben says,
"I'm glad you did it."
He's not even looking at me. He's watching the field as he says it, but I know he's talking to me. "Thanks," I say. Now he looks at me.
"No thanks necessary. It's just nice to see you out from his shadow, because things don't grow in shadows, you know? So it was frustrating to see you standing there, and really cool to see you step out of it. I don't know who this new guy is, but make sure when you're with him, you're not standing in his shadow. Stand where everyone can see you."
The crowd starts to cheer, and Ben turns back to the game, in time to see one of our players heading to the end zone.
"Come on,"
he yells, along with the rest of the crowd. The guy is tackled a few yards short.
"Oh, man,"
Ben sighs.
"Can you believe it?"
"So close," I say.
"Yeah,"
Ben says with a nod.
"So close."
I should have known there'd be an after party. "It'll be fun," Rebecca promises, taking my arm and leading me to her car. "We won't leave your side." The truth is, I don't need much convincing. I'm having a good time, an uncomplicated good time, with my friends. For a long time, I couldn't have had this. there would have always been the counterweight of Justin, the obligation of being in a couple instead of hanging with a couple of friends. This is part of freedom, not looking for anything, not missing anything, just happy with the friends who are here.
Sure, I tell Rebecca. Let's go.
It's not that late and barely dark out. There's an official after-party at some restaurant owned by a former high school quarterback, but the less-than-football crowd is gathering at Will Tyler's house, which is very conveniently located across the street from a water supply area that's never patrolled for trespassing. Will Tyler's this guy from the grade above us who sold a fantasy novel to a big publisher when he was 14. He has a banner over his door that says, "Football is for wusses. Quidditch is for gods." Preston whoops when he sees that. If the geekiness of the sign isn't enough to ward off Justin, I'm sure the complete lack of alcohol will be. Instead of beer and vodka, Will and his parents have stocked up on every single soda that's ever been created, or at least it seems that way. The bottles are lined up in identical pairs in the kitchen, like this is some kind of carbonated Noah's Ark. Some people are grumbling or pulling out flasks to spike their Fanta, but I'm into it. It's been too long since I've had a Cherry Coke. A would love this. I have no doubt A would love this. I wish he were here, not for us to be together, but so he could sample any of the sodas he never got as he bounced around his childhood.
Will Tyler's no fool, Preston says, cheersing me with a red cup of purple pop. This is a party we'll all remember.
Why, thank you,
a boy behind him says. His voice has a slightly southern twang.
Glad you could be here, Preston.
Preston turns to the boy and blurts,
"You know my name?"
Will laughs.
"Of course I know your name. It's a very nice name."
Preston smiles. Will smiles. And I'm like, "Wow, yes, go." "I need to find Rebecca," I say, even though Rebecca is all of 10 feet away from me, pouring herself a Barks. "Don't look now," I whisper when I get to her, "but I think Preston's found someone on his team." Of course, Rebecca looks over. When she turns back to me, her eyes are wide.
"Why didn't we think of this sooner?" she asks me.
"All in due time," I tell her. "And I'd say that time is due." Ben shuffles over.
"Do any of you have any idea what Verner's is? I'm trying it, and it's not bad, but I'm not sure what it's supposed to be."
"Out," Rebecca says. "Out, out, out."
We shuffle away from Preston and Will into the den where Ellie Goulding's lights is playing on high, and the lights themselves are playing on low. Looking around, I see we're mostly surrounded by smart kids, Rebecca and Ben's crowd. But I don't feel unwelcome. I think this would be A's crowd, too. I mean, he could have turned into anyone. A jerk, a druggie, a social climber, a sociopath. But after all he went through, he's basically a smart kid. I scan the crowd, looking for that recognition, even though I haven't asked him to be here. If he's here, it will have to be coincidence, fate. Someone suggests charades. The music is turned off, the lights are turned up, and Preston and Will come out of the kitchen. They're on the same charades team, of course. And when either of them is giving clues, it's the other he's looking at. More people show up, more smart kids who stopped off for dinner before coming over. It isn't until 9 that the official after-party breaks up and a whole different wave comes. Some are drunk, and some want to be drunk. Rebecca checks her phone, and there's a text from Stephanie saying they'll be here soon. "Do you want to leave?" Rebecca asks me. And I say no. I'm happy here. I don't want to leave. But still, it's awkward when Stephanie comes into the den, and I know that means Justin's somewhere in the house.
It's awkward when I hear him yelling in the kitchen, asking someone where the booze is being hidden. Steve will keep him in there, Stephanie promises me. But Steve can't keep him in there, not when there isn't any booze. Justin comes jumping out into the den, and there it is, me and him, in the same room. The look on his face when he sees me is awful, like he's been tricked, like I'm the trap.
What the fuck is she doing here?
He says. He must be 3 or 4 beers closer to drunk already. I can tell. He turns to Stephanie.
You knew she'd be here, didn't you? Why the fuck didn't you warn me?
Now Steve's on the scene, telling Justin to calm down.
Shit,
Justin says, knocking the nearest cup to the floor. It doesn't really have the effect he wants. It's plastic and full of Sprite. I'm standing there, and it's as if I've stepped away from myself for a second. I am watching this from a distance. Calmly, I am wondering what he's going to do next. Yell at me? Spit at me? Throw another cup? Burst into tears? Instead, he looks at Steve and says, with more feeling than he'd want me to hear,
"This sucks!"
Then he bolts from the room, out the front door. Steve moves to follow, but I surprise everyone in the room, including myself, by saying, "No, I've got this." Steve looks at me curiously.
"Are you sure? I have his keys."
"I'll be right back," I tell him. Then, seeing the look on Rebecca's face, I say it to her, too. "Really, I'll be right back." It's not hard to find him. I can actually see the glow of his cigarette across the street in the water supply area. It figures he'd head straight to the no trespassing signs. I let him take a few drags before I get there. "I'm coming in," I warn. Then I skirt around a tree and end up right in front of him. I can't help it. The first thing out of my mouth is, "You look like shit." Which means the first thing out of his mouth is,
"Well, you made me feel like shit, so that kinda makes sense."
"I'm sorry."
"Fuck you."
"I'm really sorry."
"Fuck you."
"Go ahead, get it out of your system."
"Why, Rhiannon? Why?"
This is worse than the fuck you. Much worse. Because now his body is transparent. I see right inside, right to who he is. And he is so upset, so wronged, so surprised. All along, I've wanted to see how much he cared. And now I get to see it. Now, when it's over.
"How long, Rhiannon? How long were you screwing some other guy? How long were you lying to me?"
"I never screwed him."
"Oh, that makes me feel so much better. The best kind of slut is one who won't put out."
I've humiliated him. I've been so busy being humiliated that I haven't realized how badly I've humiliated him. "I am so, so sorry," I say. I should be crying. But what I feel is different from sorrow. It's horror. "It's okay if you hate me," I say. He laughs.
"I don't need your permission to hate you. Jesus, listen to yourself."
I wish I could blame A. I wish I could say it's A's fault. But all A did was show me who Justin wasn't. And instead of dealing with that, I ran away. I pretended. And then I was caught.
"I don't just hate you, Rhiannon,"
Justin says.
"I hate you more than I ever thought it was possible to hate anyone. Do you know what's worse than being destroyed? It's being destroyed by someone who is never worth it. If you want me to let you off the hook, if you want me to tell you that I'm okay with everything, well, all I have to say to that is that I hope you stay on this hook for as long as you fucking live. I hope you feel it every time you kiss that guy. I hope you feel it every time you think about kissing anyone. I hope it keeps you awake at night. I hope you never sleep again. I hate you that much. So go back to that lame-ass party and drink soda and get out of my face."
No, I say, faltering. No, we need to talk. I need to tell you.
Fine. New plan. I am going to go back there, get Steve and my keys, and drive the hell away. You can stay here. I hereby give you custody of this shitty reservation. Do not follow me, and please, do not talk to me ever again.
He flicks his cigarette to the ground and walks away. I jump forward, not to follow him, but to make sure the cigarette doesn't set everything on fire. What have I done? What have I done? What have I done? Even as I'm thinking this on repeat, I'm also thinking it's a little too late to be asking this question. I want to wake up tomorrow in another body, another life. But I don't really want that. What I'm realizing is that for all the time I've spent with A, for all the time I've thought about A and A's life, I missed the most important part. Do no damage. Somehow, A can manage it in the course of a day, but I couldn't manage that in the course of a real, continuous life. I can't go back to the house, but I also can't just stand here, waiting to see Justin and Steve leave. So I walk deeper into the woods, trespass more definitively. Once I'm out of the street lamp range and the neighborhood glow, it's completely dark. As I walk among the trees, I realize this is as close to bodiless as I'm going to get. Just a mind walking through the night, unseen, unfelt, unreal. Justin was careless with me. That's undeniable. But it doesn't excuse me from being so careless with him. It explains it, but it doesn't excuse it. I lose all sense of time until I hear my name being called. More frantic with each repetition. Rebecca's voice, Preston's, Ben's, Stephanie's, Will's. I'm here, I shout. Then keep shouting it until they find me. Chapter 30. I call my parents. I tell them I'm sleeping over at Rebecca's. Then I sleep over at Rebecca's. The next morning, Will invites us back to his house for a picnic. Are you sure he's not just inviting Preston? I ask. It's 11 in the morning, and I'm not out of bed yet. Nope, Rebecca says. She's been up for at least an hour, I'm sure. All of us, me and Ben, Steve and Stephanie, Will and Preston, and you. Do you want to ask your mystery man? I can't, I say. Come on, isn't it time we met him? I just can't. What, are you ashamed of us? She's teasing, but I can tell there's a worry that it's true. No, I say, because the truth is that I'm sure A would love nothing better than a picnic with me and my friends. A would fit in perfectly. It hurts me to know this. Then why not? Because I don't think it's going to work out, I say, with him and me. I just don't think... I can't finish the sentence, because it feels so strange to say it out loud. Rebecca sits down on the bed next to me and gives me a hug. Oh, Rhiannon, she says, it's all right. I don't know why she's treating me this way, but I guess I'm crying or something. I want to tell her they're tears of confusion, not sadness. Was all of this for nothing? I think of Justin last night. I think of A out there somewhere. And I think, no, this wasn't for nothing. Even if I'm not going to be with A, I needed to stop letting Justin determine my life. I needed to find my own life. A, in a way, got me there. And it wasn't for nothing. A and I still have something, even if it's not the kind of something where he can come to a picnic with my friends. I get myself together. Sorry, I tell Rebecca. No need to be sorry, she assures me. I know. Do you want to talk about it? Yes, I want to talk about it. No, I cannot talk about it. It's just a long-distance thing. It's hard, I say. Rebecca nods, sympathetic. I know she wants to ask me more. Let's get ready for the picnic, I say. We hang out in Will's backyard and pretend it's Central Park. Nobody mentions Justin. Nobody mentions the mystery man. Except my thoughts. They mention Justin and A all the time. I am glad Justin isn't here. If he were here, it wouldn't be like this. Rebecca and Ben arguing over whether it's pretentious to pronounce croissant in a French accent when you're speaking English. Will and Preston finding every possible opportunity to touch each other on the arm, the leg, the cheek. Steve and Stephanie chilling out. Stephanie asking Steve to peel her a grape, and Steve actually doing it. Both of them laughing at how messy a process it is. If Justin were here, he'd be bored, and he'd be letting me know how bored he was. I wouldn't be able to enjoy any of my friends, because I would be so stuck on how Justin was feeling. But if A were here, it's mental picture A at first, but then it's any of the A's, because even if he was a pretty girl, or even if he was a huge guy, or even if he was poor Kelsey, back from wherever her dad sent her, there'd be a place for A, because A would appreciate this. A would understand how much this matters, to spend a day lazing around with your friends, telling inside jokes, and feeling inside of them. A has never had that, but I could give A some of mine. I could email. I could say, come on over. But I'm worried he won't understand why I'm asking. He'll think I mean we can be together. A couple. Plus, it wouldn't be fair to the person he's in. I have to remember that, too. I think about contacting him 1,000 times. For the rest of the day, in the fun moments with my friends, or in the quiet moments when I'm at home. Back at school, when I see things it would be fun to tell him about, or when the minutes seem like hours long and class never ends. I want to tell him about Justin and how now when we see each other in the halls, we ignore each other as if we're strangers, even though the way we ignore each other isn't like strangers at all. I want to tell A that he was right about Justin, but also wrong about Justin. Yes, he wasn't good for me, but no, it's not that he didn't care. That much is obvious now. Finally, on Monday night, I give in. Instead of telling A everything, I keep it simple to make sure that it's okay to keep in touch. How are you? R. Within an hour, I get his response.
It's been a rough 2 days. Apparently, I may not be the only person out there like this, which is hard to think about. A.
And just like that, I feel myself being drawn in again. I start to write a response, a long response. But after a few paragraphs, I think, no, stop. I thought there would be distance, but there isn't any distance. I know that if I involve myself again right now, it will be the same as before, and it can't be. I hold off. I call Rebecca and talk about other things. I need to build a life without A before I let him back in. Chapter 31. My friends gather around me, in school, after school, on the phone at night. Will effortlessly joins our circle. He and Preston look so happy together, and I'm happy for them, I am. But I'm also angry, because Will can join us so effortlessly, in a way A never could. Nobody mentions my mystery man anymore. Rebecca must have told them not to. Part of me still expects him to show up, expects the universe to send him into the classroom next to mine, or into Rebecca's body, or Steve's, just to say hello, just to be near. But I can't think that way. I know I can't. I find myself looking into people's eyes more than I ever did before. And I realize that's where we stop being a certain gender or color. Just look right into the center of the eye. I know I haven't answered him. It weighs on me. I know I'm not being fair. There's no point in spending all this time thinking about A without answering. I have to be honest and clear about where it can go. That's all. That's it. First thing Thursday morning, I write. I want to see you, but I'm not sure if we should do that. I want to hear about what's going on, but I'm afraid that will only start everything again. I love you, I do, but I am afraid of making that love too important, because you're always going to leave me, eh? We can't deny it. You're always going to leave. R. All through the day, there's no response, and I think, fine, I deserve that. But it's still disappointing. Then Friday at lunch, a response.
I understand. Can we please meet at the bookstore this afternoon, after school?
A. To which I say, of course. R. I'm nervous as I drive over. Everything's changed, and nothing's changed. This is going to be hard, but it feels so easy. Mostly, I want to see him, talk to him, have him be in my life. All the other obstacles have fallen away. I am even starting to believe deep in my heart that if I told my friends the truth, if they met A the way I met A on multiple days, they would believe it too. The only obstacle, really, is his life, which I know is too big an obstacle. But in the rush to see him, it doesn't seem as big as maybe it should. I get there first. I scan the cafe and know that none of these people could be him. If he were here, he'd be looking for me. He'd know when I arrived. So I sit down. I wait. And the minute he walks through the door, I know, like there's a shiver of lightning between us. Today, he's this thin Asian guy wearing a blue t-shirt with Cookie Monster on it. When A sees me, his smile is wider than Cookie Monster's.
Hey,
he says. And this time, I say it back, gladly. Hey. So, here we are. I'm trying to remind myself to not fall back into it, to not start thinking it's possible. But with him right here, that's hard.
I have an idea, he says.
What? He smiles again.
Let's pretend this is the first time we've ever met. Let's pretend you were here to get a book, and I happened to bump into you. We struck up a conversation. I like you. You like me. Now we're sitting down to coffee. It feels right. You don't know that I switch bodies every day. I don't know about your ex or anything else. We're just two people meeting for the first time.
The lie we want to believe. That feels dangerous. But why? I ask.
So we don't have to talk about everything else. So we can just be with each other. Enjoy it.
I have to tell him. I don't see the point.
No past. No future. Just present. Give it a chance.
I want to. I know I want to. So I will. I know it's not as easy as that, but it can at least start by being as easy as that. It's very nice to meet you, I tell him. I feel like I'm a bad actress in a bad movie. But he likes it.
It's very nice to meet you as well, he says. Where should we go?
You decide, I tell him. What's your favorite place? He thinks about it for a second. Whether he's inside his own thoughts or this boy's thoughts, I don't know. His smile gets wider.
I know just the place, he says. But first, we'll need groceries.
Well, luckily, there's a food store down the street.
My, how lucky we are.
I laugh. What? He asks. My, how lucky we are. You're such a goofball.
I am happy to be your ball of goof.
You sound like Preston.
Who's Preston?
He really doesn't know. How could he? I've never told him. So, as we walk over to the grocery store, I introduce him to all of my friends. He knows Rebecca and vaguely remembers Steve and Stephanie, but I tell him more about them and about Preston and Ben and even Will, too. It's weird because I know I can't ask him the same questions back, but he seems okay with that. Once we get to the grocery store, A says we're going to go down all the aisles.
You never know what you might miss, he tells me.
And what are we shopping for? I ask.
Dinner, he says. Definitely dinner. And as we do, keep telling me stories.
He asks me about pets, and I tell him more about Swizzle, this evil bunny rabbit we had, who would escape his cage and sleep on our faces. It was terrifying. I ask him if he had a favorite pet, and he tells me that one day he had a pet ferret that seemed to understand it had a guest in the house, so it made his life as difficult as possible, but also gave him something to do because no one else was home during the day. When we get to the produce aisle, he tells me a story about this time at camp where he got hit in the eye by a flying greased watermelon. I tell him I can't remember being injured by any fruit, although there was a good few years when I made my mom cut up apples before I'd eat them, because someone at school had told me about psychos who put razor blades inside. We get to the cereal aisle, which isn't really going to help us for dinner. But A stops there anyway and asks me for my life story told in cereals. Okay, I say, getting what he means. I begin by holding up a cylinder of Quaker oatmeal. It all starts with this. My mother barely eats breakfast, but my dad always has oatmeal. So I decided I liked oatmeal too, especially with bananas. It wasn't until I was 7 or 8 that I realized how gross it was. I pick up a box of Frosted Flakes. This is where the battle began. Rebecca's mom let her have Frosted Flakes, and like everyone else, I'd seen the commercials for them a zillion times. I begged my mother to let me eat them. She said no. So I did what any law-abiding girl would do. I stole a box from Rebecca's house and kept it in my room. The only problem was I was afraid my mom would catch me putting the bowls in the dishwasher, so I kept them in my room. And they began to stink. She threw a holy fit, but my dad was there, and he said he didn't see the harm in Frosted Flakes if that's what I wanted. The punchline being, of course, that once I had them, they disappointed me. They got so soggy so fast. So my mom and I reached a compromise. I walk him over to the Frosted Cheerios. Now, I'm not sure why Frosted Cheerios are any better than Frosted Flakes, but my mom seemed to think so. Which brings us to our grand finale. I make a production of choosing from the 90 kinds of granola before landing on my favorite cinnamon raisin kind. In truth, this probably has just as much sugar in it as anything frosted, but I have at least the illusion of health, and the raisins are satisfying, and it doesn't get soggy right away.
I used to love how the Frosted Flakes turned the milk blue, A says.
Yeah, when did that stop being cool and start being gross?
Probably the same time that I realized there was not, in fact, any fruit in Fruit Loops,
or any honey in Honeycomb,
or any chocolate in Count Chocula.
At least the Frosted Flakes had flakes in them.
And frostedness.
Yes, and frostedness. Talking like this, I am forgetting that this isn't A. I am forgetting that we're not on a regular date. Moving on, I say, taking us to the next aisle and the one after. We pick up a ridiculous amount of food. As we're nearing the checkout, I realize there's no way I am going to be getting home when my parents are expecting me. I should call my mom and tell her I'm eating at Rebecca's, I tell A.
Tell her you're staying over, he says.
My phone is in my hand, but I don't know what to do with it.
Really?
Really. Staying over. I think about the cabin, about what happened, I mean, what didn't happen, and how that felt. I'm not sure that's a good idea, I say.
Trust me. I know what I'm doing.
I want to trust him, but he also doesn't know what it was like, and he might have the wrong idea of what a night might lead to. You know how I feel, I say.
I do, but still, I want you to trust me. I'm not going to hurt you. I will never hurt you.
Okay. I look into his eyes, and I feel like he knows. There's a plan. There's definitely a plan. But it's not going to be a repeat of the cabin. He knows what he's doing, and I do trust that. I call my mother and tell her I'm at Rebecca's and will be staying there. She's annoyed, but I can deal with that. The harder part is calling Rebecca. I need you to cover for me, I say. If my mom calls for any reason, tell her I'm over.
Where are you? She asks. Are you okay?
I am. I promise I'll tell you about it later. I can't right now, but I'm okay. I might not even be out the whole night. I just want to make sure I'm covered.
Are you sure?
Yes, really. It's good.
Okay,
but I expect a full explanation this time, not your usual evasion. I promise. I'll tell you everything. She says to have a good time. I think it's remarkable that she's trusting me, but she is.
You'll tell her you met a boy, A says, once I've hung up.
A boy I just met?
Yeah, a boy you've just met.
It's strange to think of that conversation. No longer a mystery man, just a boy. If only it were that easy. I follow him in my car. This is the moment I could decide not to go. All I need to do is turn the steering wheel. All I need to do is return to the highway. But I keep going. His name is Alexander Lin, and his parents are away for the weekend. A tells me both things at once. Alexander, I say, that's easy enough to remember.
Why?
He asks. I thought it was obvious. Because it begins with A. He laughs, surprised. I guess it wasn't as obvious from the inside. The house is a very nice house. The kitchen is about twice the size of our kitchen, and the refrigerator, when we open it, is already pretty full. Alexander's parents did not leave him to starve.
Why did we bother?
I ask. I can barely find space to put away what we bought.
Because I didn't notice what was in here this morning, and I wanted to make sure we had exactly what we desired.
Do you know how to cook?
Not really. You?
This is going to be interesting.
Not really.
I guess we'll figure it out. But first, there's something I want to show you.
Okay.
He reaches for my hand, and I let him take it. We walk like this through the house, up the stairs, to what is clearly Alexander's bedroom. It's amazing. First of all, there are sticky notes everywhere. Yellow squares, pink squares, blue squares, green squares. And on each of them, there's a quote. I don't believe in fairy tales, but I believe in you. And let all the dreamers wake the nation. And love me less, but love me for a long time. I could spend hours reading his room. In a field, I am the absence of field. Mark Strand. Most of the quotes are in one handwriting, but there's other handwriting, too. His friends. This is something he shares with his friends. There are pictures of these friends, too, and the way they arrange themselves, looks like the way my friends would arrange themselves. Not Justin. Never Justin, who didn't like having his picture taken. But Rebecca and Preston and the others, they would like it here. There's a lime green couch to hang out on, and guitars to strum, and what looks like the full collection of Calvin and Hobbes. I look at the records he has leaning against the record player. Bands I don't know, but like the sound of God Help the Girl, We Were Promised Jetpacks, Kings of Convenience. I read more of the sticky notes. We are all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars. I check out the books on his shelves. Most of them have sticky notes sticking out, pages to be collected, words to be remembered after they've been forgotten. I like it. I like it all. I turn to A, and know he likes it too. If he could have a room, this would be it. How cool that he's found it, and how depressing that he'll have to leave it in a few hours. But I'm not going to think about that. I'm going to think about now. I see an almost finished pad of sticky notes on Alexander's desk and put it in my pocket, along with a pen. Time for dinner, A says. He takes my hand again. We head back into the world, but not too far into it, not too far away from this. I find some cookbooks. We choose, by and large, to ignore them. Improvise, A says. And I think, yes, that's what we're doing. Improvising, living by instincts. It's a big kitchen, but we make it feel like a small space. We fill it with music from Alexander's iPod and steam from the boiling pots and smells as different as basil picked from the stem and garlic sautéed against a flame. There's no plan here, just ingredients. I am sweating along and singing along, and I am not stressed, because even if none of it ends up edible, it's still worth it just to be putting it together. I think about my parents and how they've missed this sensation of working together, or putting your hands on the back of the person as he stands at the stove, or having one person start the sauce, but the other person take it over without a word. We are a team of two, and since it's not a competition, we've already won. In the end, we have a kale salad, garlic bread, a huge pasta primavera, a quinoa and apricot salad, and a pan of lemon squares. Not bad, A says. And what I want to tell him is that now I understand why people want to share a life with someone else. I see what all the fuss is about. It's not about sex or being in a couple when you hang out with other couples. It's not for ego gratification or fear of loneliness. It's about this, whatever this is. And the only thing wrong with it right now is that I'm sharing it with someone who's bound to leave. I don't say any of this, because the last part makes all the rest of it harder to say. Should I set the table? I ask instead. The Lynns have a very nice dining room table, and a feast like this seems fit for a very nice dining room table. A shakes his head. No, I'm taking you to my favorite place, remember? He looks through the cupboards until he finds two trays. The food we've made barely manages to fit on them. Then A finds a bunch of candles and takes them along, too. Here, he says, handing me one of the trays. Then he leads me out the back door. Where are we going? I ask. I don't even have my jacket. I hope we're not going far. Look up, he says. At first, all I see is the tree. Then I look closer and see the treehouse. Nice, I say, finding the ladder. There's a pulley system for the trays. I'll go up and drop it down. These parents have thought of everything. As I balance the trays, A heads up the ladder and sends a platform down. I'm not sure how balanced it's going to be, but I put one of the trays on and A manages to pull it up without anything falling off. We repeat this for the second tray, and then it's my turn to go up the ladder. It's like something I've read about in a book. It never occurred to me that kids could actually have tree houses in their backyards. There's an open door at the top, and I climb right through. A has lit some of the candles, so the air flickers as I pull myself inside. I look around and see what's basically a log cabin stuck in the air. There isn't much furniture, but there's a guitar and some notebooks, a small bookshelf with an old encyclopedia on it. A has put the trays in the middle of the floor, since there isn't any table and there aren't any chairs.
"Pretty cool, isn't it?" A says.
"Yeah."
"It's all his. His parents don't come up here."
"I love it." I take the plates, napkins, and silverware from one of the trays and set the table that isn't a table. When I'm done, A serves some of everything for each of us. As we sit across from each other, we comment on the food. It's all turned out better than it has any reason to be. The sauce on the pasta primavera tastes like a spice I can't quite identify. I ask A what it is, and he doesn't remember. He thinks I might have put it in. I don't remember either. It was all just part of the improvisation. There's a carafe of water on one of the trays, and that's all we need. We could have wine. We could have vodka. We could have cherry cokes. It would all be the same. We're drunk on candlelight, intoxicated by air. The food is our music. The walls are our warmth. As the first candles diminish, A lights more. There isn't brightness, but there's a glow. I've just taken my first bite of a lemon square, its tartness still on my tongue. I catch A watching me and assume I have some powdered sugar on my face. I move to wipe it off. He smiles, still looking. "What?" I ask. He leans over and kisses me.
"That,"
he says. "Oh," I say, "that."
"Yes, that."
We hang there, waiting for the kiss to leave the room, to float off into the night. I have no idea what I want. No, not true. I know exactly what I want. I'm just not sure if I should want it. "Dessert," I say. "You need to try a lemon square." He smiles. It's okay to let the kiss leave the room. Already, I feel others knocking on the door. I look at his lips, the powdered sugar on his lips. I remind myself they're not really his lips. I'm not sure I care. When we're done, I gather up the dishes. I put everything on the trays, and then I push the trays aside. We've been sitting too far from each other. I want us so much closer. I move right next to him. He puts his arm around me, and I take the pad of sticky notes out of my pocket, along with the pen. Without saying a word, I draw a heart on the top sticky note, then put it on Alexander's heart. "There," I say to A. He looks down at it, then back up at me.
"I have to tell you something," he says.
For a moment, I think this will be the "I love you" that's even greater than the others. If he says it, I will respond. But instead, he says,
"I have to tell you what's been going on."
Instead of leaning into him, I move so I can see his eyes. "What?" I ask. Irrationally, I wonder if he's met someone else.
"Do you remember Nathan Daldry, the boy I was at Steve's party?"
"Of course."
"I left him on the side of the road that night, and when he woke up, he knew something was wrong. He suspected something wasn't right, so he told a lot of people. And one of the people who found out, he calls himself Reverend Poole. But he's not Reverend Poole. He's someone in Reverend Poole's body."
"This is what you were talking about when you emailed and said you thought you weren't the only one. A nods.
Yes, but that's not all of it. Whoever's inside Pool is like me, but not entirely like me. He says he can control it. He says there's a way to stay in a person's body.
I try to wrap my mind around what he's saying. Who told you this? Did you email him? How do you know he's real?
I saw him. I met him. He used Nathan to set a trap, and he almost got me. He says we're the same, but we're not the same. I don't know how to explain it. I don't think he uses the same rules as I do. I don't think he cares about the people he inhabits. I don't think he respects what we are.
But you believe him? When he says you can stay?
I think so. And I think there might be others, too. On the Internet, I think I've found others. Or at least other people who were inhabited, like Nathan or you. You at least know what happened, and Nathan knows now. But most of them never know. And if Poole's right, there may be others who've been taken over permanently. Someone like me could go into them and then not leave.
So you can stay? I ask, not believing this is what he's telling me. Suddenly, anything is possible. We're possible. Are you saying you can stay?
Yes, he answers. And no.
It can't be both. I don't want to hear it's both. Which one? What do you mean?
There might be a way to stay, he tells me. But I can't. I'll never be able to stay.
Why not?
Because I'd be killing them, Rhiannon. When you take over someone's life, they're gone forever.
No, he can't be saying this. He can't be saying it's possible and impossible at the same time. I can't deal with it. I can't. I have to stand up. I can't be sitting on the floor in the middle of a treehouse having this conversation with him. Once I'm up, I start to boil over. You can't do this, I'm telling him. You can't swoop in, bring me here, give me all this, and then say it can't work. That's cruel, eh? Cruel!
I know, he says. That's why this is a first date. That's why this is the first time we've ever met.
Not fair. This is not pretend. This is life. How can you say that? I ask. How can you erase everything else? He stands up and comes over to me. Even though I'm mad, even though I don't understand what he's doing, he wraps his arms around me. It's not what I want, and I try to tell him I don't want it. But then I feel the shelter of his closeness, and I want it, and I stop trying to pull away.
He's a good guy,
A whispers in my ear.
He might even be a great guy, and today's the day you first met. Today's your first date. He's going to remember being in the bookstore. He's going to remember the first time he saw you, and how he was drawn to you, not just because you're beautiful, but because he could see your strength. He could see how much you want to be a part of the world. He'll remember talking with you, how easy it was, how engaging. He'll remember not wanting it to end, and asking you if you wanted to do something else. He'll remember your asking him his favorite place, and he'll remember thinking about here and wanting to show it to you. The grocery store, the stories in the aisles, the first time you saw his room, that will all be there, and I won't have to change a single thing. His pulse is my heartbeat. The pulse is the same. I know he will understand you. You have the same kind of heart.
No, this is not what I want. Can't he see what I want? But what about you? I ask, my voice stained by my sadness. I can't keep it away from him.
You'll find things in him that you find in me, he answers, without the complications.
He says it like it's easy. It's not easy. I can't just switch like that, I tell him. His arms draw me closer.
I know. He'll have to prove it to you. Every day he'll have to prove he's worthy of you. And if he doesn't,
That's it. But I think he will.
He's giving up. Whether or not I want him to, he's giving up. Why are you doing this? I ask.
Because I have to go, Rhiannon. For real, this time. I have to go far away. There are things I need to find out, and I can't keep stepping into your life. You need something more than that.
I know this makes sense, but I don't want to make sense. I don't want anything to make sense. So this is goodbye? I ask him.
It's goodbye to some things, he says, and hello to others.
This is where I turn. This is where I stop being held and decide to hold. This is where I loosen myself from his arms, but only to unfold my own arms and welcome him there. I am not saying yes, but I am agreeing that there's no point in me saying no. I hold him with everything I have. I hold him with so much that he will have to remember it. He will have to remember me, wherever he is.
I love you, he says, like I've never loved anyone before.
You always say that. But don't you realize it's the same for me? I've never loved anyone like this either.
But you will. You will again.
This is where it stops. This is where it begins. Every moment. Every day. This is where it stops. This is where it begins. I haven't been looking at the clock, but now I look at the clock. It's almost midnight. Where it stops. Where it begins.
I want to fall asleep next to you,
he whispers to me. This is my last wish. I nod. I'm afraid to open my mouth. I am afraid I will not be able to say what he wants me to say. We leave the trays in the treehouse. It doesn't matter, if this is what he's going to remember anyway. Climbing down the ladder, running back to the house, heading to his room. We will remember this together, all three of us. I want to stop time. I know I cannot stop time. Holding hands, then inside the room, stopping to take off our shoes. Nothing else, just shoes. I crawl into the bed. He turns off the lights. Only the glow of the clock. He gets into the bed next to me, lying on his back. I curl into him, touch his cheek, turn his head, kiss him and kiss him and kiss him. I want you to remember that tomorrow, I say, when we come up for air.
I'll remember everything,
he tells me. So will I promise. One more kiss, one last kiss. Then I close my eyes. I steady my breathing. I wait. If I could hold on to him, I would. Lord, if I could hold on to him, I would. I do not sleep. I wish I could sleep, but I cannot sleep. Instead, I lie there, eyes closed, safe in the dark. I feel him reach over and touch my heart. I hear him say goodbye. I feel him close his eyes. I feel him fall. I open my eyes. I turn. I look for the moment. I want to see the change. But instead, I find a beautiful someone, beautifully asleep, left behind by another beautiful someone, now also asleep, in some other house, in some other bed. I want to wake him. I want to ask him if he's still there. But I don't wake him, because I don't want Alexander to ask me why I'm crying. It isn't until I'm turned back to the wall, until I've decided to will myself to sleep, that I feel the sticky note on my shirt. The heart I gave him. He's taken it and given it back to me. Chapter 32. I open my eyes. There is sunlight.
Good morning,
Alexander says. At some point in the night, I must have turned toward him, because he's right there in front of me, also waking up. Good morning, I say. He doesn't look confused. He doesn't look surprised. He understands why we're in his bed, fully clothed. He remembers the treehouse. He remembers meeting me in the bookstore. It's unusual, for sure. It's not the kind of thing that happens every day. But it's possible. On a very lucky day, it's possible. He looks so happy, and completely unafraid to show it.
Why don't I make breakfast? He says. I seem to recall my parents left us with plenty of breakfast options.
Breakfast would be good, I say, sitting up and stretching out.
Okay,
he replies. But he doesn't make any move to go. He just looks at me. What? I ask.
Nothing,
he says, bashful.
Then he corrects himself. No, not nothing. The opposite of nothing. I'm just really glad you're here. And I'm looking forward to another day with you, if you'll do me the pleasure.
Breakfast first, I say. Then we can figure this out.
Sounds good, he says, bouncing out of bed. Help yourself to clothes, towels, shampoo, books, post-its, whatever you need.
Will do. He teeters in the room for a moment. He looks so sweet.
I love this, whatever it is,
he says. I can't help but smile back at him. Yes, I say, whatever it is.
No oatmeal, right?
Yep, no oatmeal. He whistles as he heads downstairs. I listen until he's too far to hear. His laptop sits on his desk, beckoning me. I know what I should do. I know what A wants me to do. Only I'm stubborn now. I like Alexander, but I want A. I want to find A.
This is Kathleen McInerney. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Another Day by David Levithan. This program was directed by Arthur G. Insana. Executive producer, Aaron Blank. Text copyright 2015 by David Levithan. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.